Well, greetings again, everyone. What is this book all about? When you stop to think about how would you tell someone else, especially from an Islamic country or from China, Japan, some other nation that does not acknowledge the so-called nominal Christian God, the Christian Bible, the Judeo-Christian ethic, what is that book all about? One way I would present it to you is that it is the handbook from the Creator to His creation to tell us why we are on the earth, to tell us what we are, to tell us what is the ultimate human destiny, what is our purpose, what is our goal, and what happens after we die. There's nothing quite so obvious to a heathen as the cycle of life. That's why so many of them made up stories about life beginning in an egg, because after all, they could see a hen's egg or a duck egg or a bird's egg and a little beak pecking its way free. And they were just absolutely amazed at the fact that there was a new little creature that came out of that egg. They could see horses and cattle born, and they could see their own children born. They knew where babies came from. And so every now and then, they decided to give one back to the so-called gods in which they believed. There's another way I could present this book to you. It is an outline for a future world government. It is a book about beings who dwell in outer space, who visited this earth, left upon it a prototype that looks like them, both male and female, gave them orders and instructions to populate this earth, gave them complete control over all the animals and fish, over all the flora and fauna, and told them to dress it and to keep it, not to pollute it and destroy it. You read the story of that, of course, and we've read it interminably and heard about it some time we were children over in the first few chapters of Genesis. That isn't my purpose to go into that today, but I want to talk about globalism and the new world order. You see, I believe in globalism. And I believe in the new world order, but not in the hands of man. I do not believe in globalism in the hands of the so-called United Nations. I call them the disunited non-nations, because if you look up places like Burkina Faso, try to find that on a map, or Seychelles or Nauru or some of the others that I've talked about, and I've been going through some of their websites recently, by the way. I did a lot of research. I was all over Western and Northern and Central Africa the other day, looking at all of the newspapers from places like that. And when you go to places like Mogadishu and you read what's going on there, I was telling my wife after I'd spent an hour or two looking through some of that about all the floods. It was one place in southern Ethiopia where about 114 people had died. Many were being eaten by crocodiles because they'd had horrible floods and people were taken to the high ground and crocodiles were coming out and infesting the area. And you go to Nigeria, you go to the former Uganda and some of the former colonies of East Africa, there are tribal wars and there are droughts, there are floods, there are famines, terrible loss of life. Now you look at what happened the other day in Morocco, and just now, hours ago, a man in Hebron rushed toward a group of girls, Jewish girls, coming back from prayer. A policeman yelled at him, "Stop!" And he ran as fast as he could. He only managed to blow himself and one other person up, and injure one, but he would have killed about 30 if he'd have gotten close enough. So you know the world is in a wretched, rotten mess. Anybody with a brain in his head knows the world is in terrible trouble. I could talk for the next 4 hours about the proliferation of nuclear weapons, the construction of weapons of mass destruction, the fact that Syria has North Korean missiles and has been testing them for years, that Syria is also working, as is Iran, on nuclear weapons. Few of you know that, for example, third behind the United States and France, Japan has the largest number of nuclear reactors in the world. Without going through all the problems of the world, suffice it to say that when the United Nations was formed, it was formed in the immediate aftermath of World War II, when perhaps up to 70 million people had died. Two world wars in less than one full generation, and especially the wars that had soaked Europe in blood for all of the decades and centuries of its existence, the age-old tribalism, group instinct, cultural differences, language differences, religious hatreds and differences. You know, the Balkans actually became under the sway of the Ottoman Turkish Empire, which was written off at the end of World War I, finally, after that hideous thing at Gallipoli. By the way, I'll bet none of you know about Gallipoli. You probably haven't heard about that, the peninsula that enters into the Sea of Marmara and the Bosporus Dardanelles. No big deal, only 250,000 British died there in World War I, a war that most people know nothing about or forgotten all about, never knew about, unless they're a buff of history and read about things like that. Disastrous campaign for Britain at that time, finally had to withdraw ignominiously, and there were people from the colonies there. There were the Anzacs. As a matter of fact, do you know why the Australians are to this day called diggers? It was in the Battle of Gallipoli, they were there digging trenches, and the British were looking at them saying, all I do all day is dig, so they called them the diggers. All right, enough of that. I'm just trying to skip along over some things about the world to tell you that this world is not in very good shape, that the future of the world is not bright, that we are in a world right now where one of the major world religions is at war with all the other major world religions, Judaism and nominal Christianity. And that religion is Islam. And one of its offshoots is the Wahhabi sect of Saudi Arabia that is one of the most militant. Now, without detailing all the trauma and the agony and the bombings and the loss of life of this last week, in Saudi Arabia itself, the threats of Jeddah, and what just now happened in Morocco, I want you to realize that the only solution, and they were quite right when they wrote the Charter of the United Nations, that the only hope for mankind is one world government. One world government. But the problem is, they only see a world government in the hands of man. And because innately they know that mankind is divided with all of these different racial, ethnic, cultural, linguistic, socioeconomic, and religious differences, they know the only way, in their limited understanding, denial of God, of course, for them to have a so-called New World Order is to coalesce with representatives from all of those disparate groups to come together at the conference table and to forever eschew war, to abolish war, to say that war is not the way to settle grievances and differences among and between nations. Hence, we have the United Nations. Now, I've written very lengthy articles about it. You can look at them on our website. In one extremely lengthy one, I detailed by putting the secretaries general at the top of each one of them that have been, as you know, from third world countries. They searched the world over for a non-aligned country. They could never have one from the United States, from Germany, from Britain, from any of the Western Allied powers. Certainly they couldn't have anyone from the Warsaw Pact nations, so there was never a Hungarian or a Pole or a Czechoslovak or someone from the aligned countries of the Soviet Union. No Russian could ever have been the Secretary General. So they found people like U Thant from Myanmar, or they found people like Trygve Lie from Norway, or they found an Austrian with a former Nazi record. Now they got a guy from Africa. And a lot of people, of course, think that that's just absolutely wonderful in our multicultural world. We've got Kofi Annan at the head of the United Nations. I wonder if you know just how much the United Nations is intruding into the United States of America. There was a columnist who recently visited Independence Hall. Independence Hall is the very cradle of our American civilization. It's where the great documents were forged and signed and put into law. It's the place where the founding fathers met in Philadelphia. There's a bronze plaque there. I want to read to you the inscription. Quote, "Through the collective recognition of the community of nations expressed with the principles of the Convention concerning protection of the world's cultural and natural heritage, Independence Hall has been designated a World Heritage Site and joins a select list of protected areas around the world whose outstanding natural and cultural resources form the common inheritance of all mankind," end of quote. I want to read that again. Independence Hall forms a part of the world's cultural natural heritage. Independence Hall has joined a select list of protected areas around. Independence Hall hadn't joined anything. But beginning with the Nixon administration, and especially with the Clinton administration, they signed under a United Nations group, places like Yellowstone, Yosemite National Park, the story about Yellowstone and a nearby mining company that would have hired about 280 people and put many hundreds of millions of dollars into the American economy, deterred from actually mining because of this signing with the United Nations, so that now the United Nations is monitoring and allegedly supervising America's national parks and monuments. The average American has no idea the extent to which our personal liberties are being eroded, the extent to which the disunited non-nations are encroaching into our country, the extent to which our administrations, many of them, Democrat and Republican, have gone along with the United Nations and actually sold America's liberty, heritage, and freedom down the river. You know, man from the very beginning tried to form treaties and pacts. They were, of course, found by Almighty God in Genesis trying to coalesce into a one-world government. If you read of that in Genesis 11, 1-9, it says the whole earth was of one language and of one speech, and it came to pass as they journeyed toward the east, as it should read, they found a plain in the land of Shinar. That's modern-day Babylon in Mesopotamia, that means the land between the rivers, and dwelt there. And they said one to another, go on, or come on, let's make brick and burn them thoroughly. They had brick for stone and slime they had for mortar. The word for slime is bitumen. And as you know, Iraq is rich in oil resources, and some of it was actually bubbling onto the ground. So the very thick, almost tar-like substance called bitumen, which is really a form of heavy crude oil, was used to help them put their buildings together. They said, come on, or go to, let's build a city and a tower. You always have to have cities that have towers. You got to have a monument. A church has to have something impudently sticking up into the heavens to indicate what it really stands for. The people in Islam make no bones about it. When you look at a minaret on a mosque, it's really more actually accurate as it is over in Austria and southern Germany and places like that, where the steeple doesn't come to quite the same spire-like tip that it does over little churches here and there in the United States. I've seen people that actually form small church groups and buy a private house. Then they got to go out and buy a little metal aluminum steeple and stick it on the front pitch of the roof so it indicates here is a group with this impudent thing, if you ever investigate the actual origin of the steeple and what it's supposed to mean. Just as you have Cleopatra's Needle, a very large replica of it at the end of the mall in Washington, D.C., opposite the Capitol building, which stands for the father of our country. Anyhow, be that as it may, that's what they were going to build. It was at once a symbol of fatherhood, of nationhood, and a symbol which was meant to gather them together, something in which they could take pride. It would probably have fires burning on the top of it, like a signal, and they could see it from 100 or so miles away. And it would be a rallying symbol. It would be like a national monument. They said, let us reach one whose top may reach unto heaven. Now, it's been proposed years in the past that they were trying to, quote, get to heaven. That's, of course, nonsense. You can see in the distance snow-capped mountains, and some of them go up to 30-some thousand feet. They weren't so stupid. They thought they'd be down in that valley almost at sea level and build a tower a few hundred feet when they could climb up to 30-some thousand feet and build it there. So what it was a, quote, skyscraper. Now, our big, tall buildings do not scrape the sky. In the Latin or Spanish language, it is in Mexico City, it is rascacielos, which is to scratch. Rascar is to scratch, and cielo is the ceiling or the sky, so it's a skyscraper. And we have skyscrapers, but they don't really scrape the sky. They're just big, tall buildings that appear to soar up into the heavens, and there's a kind of a subliminal yearning, a subliminal desire of mankind, a kind of an unspoken statement made by tall spires, tall monuments, tall buildings. Men really love to build things taller and taller and taller, like the Sears Tower. I understand after the two Twin Trade Towers came down that the Sears Tower, now in Chicago, is the largest, tallest building in the world. And one of the proposals for the reconstruction of some kind of a monumental building or a collection of them on the site of the old Twin Trade Towers is going to be, once again, the tallest building in the world. So God said, as they were doing this, he came down to see the city and the tower and said, behold, the people is one. And they have all one language, so communication was no problem. Everyone could understand everyone. And this they begin to do. And now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. Go on, or let us go down. Notice the plural used time and again. Let us go down. Genesis 1:26, let us make man in our image. Elohim is a plural word meaning more than one. And confound their language that they may not understand one another's speech. Can you understand a Vietnamese? Can you understand a Portuguese? Can you understand a Laotian? Can you understand a Japanese? Can you understand a Chinese? No, of course not. So for centuries, man has been divided among all of these various languages. When you see someone of a different color, his eyes are different, he dresses different, he walks differently, he speaks in a strange tongue that you can't understand, you may be smitten with what is called xenophobia, kind of a fear of foreigners. And you don't like him, and you want to shy away from him. All of a sudden, everybody is standing around gibbering in a different Babylonish tongue. They began shying away from one another, moving over here and moving over there and getting away from one another. Why did God do that? He scattered them abroad because he said nothing would be restrained from them which they had imagined to do. Now, there is nothing, it seems, that humans cannot imagine that they are able to do. I don't know if you know that there are tens of thousands of bodies that have already been frozen, expecting that science will find a way to thaw them out and they'll come back to life. I don't know if you know that there are actual sperm banks that have been launched into the heavens. I don't know if you know that men have actually donated sperm so that they can survive themselves when it is learned how they can be, quote, cloned, which is a stupid idea because it's not them originally anyway, any more than Dolly the sheep was its own mother. But they have these ideas and are actually people that have done that, and it's frozen and waiting for its use at some time in the future. They have thought that manned spaceflight, and that's what they're doing up there, would eventually be a kind of a space-age Noah's Ark, even though they acknowledge it would take them 55 years at the speed of light to reach Aldebaran. They pursue, nevertheless, the goals through NASA and the expenditure of a wasted number of billions of dollars to explore space, because man yearns to get out into space and to leave this earth. He hasn't learned to live by himself together on this earth as yet. Now, they were scattered abroad. I want to remind you that my father was born in 1892. He died in 1986. He was born before the Wright brothers ever flew at Kitty Hawk. Before he died, he went around this globe at least 40-some times in a G2, around and around and around the world, collecting autographs from tired old dictators. All right. At the beginning of World War II, even, for example, in the sinking of the Bismarck, there were what were called swordfish, bi-wing British torpedo bombers that flew off the decks of the Royal Oak, and so, not the Royal Oak, that was the battleship sunk up in the Scapa Flow, but some of their aircraft carriers, and were actually used to hit the steering mechanism, the rudder, of that huge capital ship and aided in its sinking. Now stop to think of that. You had rag wing. We're talking about fabric wings coated with a kind of a seconite, old, ancient, what were called tail dragger aircraft, not even tricycle landing gear oftentimes, at the beginning of World War II. By the time World War II was over, the Germans and the British both had jet engines. The jet engine was first beginning to be developed in 1924. But it didn't become operational until about 1945. Had it become operational 1 year earlier, we would not have won the war. It's just that simple. The Messerschmitt 262 was an incredible aircraft and shot down an awful lot of American planes and British. Well, I'm merely pointing that out to talk about once nations, especially under the impetus of warfare, where they crank up what's called R&D, research and development, to a fever pitch. If I were to stand here and give you the statistics of the numbers of huge four-engine bombers that came rolling off our assembly lines at the plants up in Michigan and all over the United States during World War II, to the tune of several thousand a month, the fact that Kaiser and his shipyards up out of Portland, Oregon, was building one ship a day, the way we mobilized during World War II, the millions of people who pooled their knowledge and information to propel us into the jet age. Shortly thereafter, we were propelled into the space age. The nuclear bomb was exploded, as you know, in 1945. And then Sputnik preempted us in the early 1950s, And we got very busy under the Kennedy administration, and he began to put massive amounts of American money into a space program. And very soon, Shepard, of course, was the first one in a suborbital pattern, and we put man into space capsules, and eventually they were launched into space. Now, man has been on the moon and is assaying and planning to go to Mars. Is God going to allow that? And do you think that the world is going to exist in this sort of a disequilibrium that we presently see of the gray in between the war which must not be fought and the peace which cannot be achieved, cranking in now a feverish arms race all over the world? It's starting in Japan. Japan is now arguing with the Diet about the rewriting of its constitution exactly as I warned over 40 years ago. They have already reinterpreted it to the extent that their Aegis destroyers, and they've got the Congo-class destroyers with the Aegis guided missile systems aboard, most of you don't know anything about. Most people are not a bit perturbed or disturbed that the Japanese build F-15E or J Strike Eagles all the way from the ground up, every component, every part in Japan, or that the expert laser-guided munitions, precision munitions that we use in a war in Iraq, many of them have in their guidance systems computer chips that were manufactured in Japan. And we couldn't have won the war without the Japanese contribution of trade with Japan. I said before you, you remember that I did, back when Kim Jong-il, the son of the other one, was saying that he was going to start reprocessing spent reactor rods and he's going to have a nuclear program. I said, we don't need to worry about it, like America having the problems all over the world become our problems. I said, that's going to become a Japanese problem. Japanese take care of that. They're in the neighborhood. Well, guess what? Japanese starting to argue about going nuclear. And they got the third largest number of nuclear reactors in the world. Most Americans know nothing about that. If you were to see one of the sleek, fast greyhounds of the sea, the destroyers of the Congo class, coming by armed with supersonic missiles, and to know that they are able to hit targets who knows how many hundreds of miles away, if you were to see a squadron of F-15 Strike Eagles going by with a big blazing sun on it, might wake you up. You'd say, what are those doing? I didn't know the Japanese had the same kind of aircraft, and even superior in some ways to ours. Oh, yes, they sure do. So there's probably going to be an arms race in the Middle East. I want to go back in history now because this is an interpretation from one of the most ancient cuneiform Babylonian tablets. So far as historians and archaeologists know, this is the first attempt at a pact or a treaty where one king and the Hittite kings were referred to as Sun, S-O-N. They referred to themselves as the Sun. They claimed the same privileges as the emperors of Japan, direct descendants of the Sun. So, this Sun of the Hittites is writing in a cuneiform tablet all of the precepts and the binding agreements that he intends to enforce between himself and the Akkadians. Remember, Akkad is mentioned in the Bible as one of the cities that Nimrod built. Here is the exact wording from Babylonian cuneiform of the most ancient pact between two armed governments of which humanity has a record. Quote, may the sun god of heaven, the sun goddess of Ariana, the storm god of heaven, the Hattian storm god, Cirrus and Horus, Mount Nanni and Mount Hazi, the storm god of Halab, the storm god of Zipalandia, the storm god of Nerik, the storm god of Lehazna, the storm god of Hishapa, the storm god of Sabina, the storm god of Taaya, the storm god of Betiarik, the storm god of Sumaha, the storm god of Hurma, the storm god of Saresa, the storm god of Uda, the storm god of Kitsiwatna, the storm god of Ishupita, the storm god of Nuasi, may the patron god of Zuhrius, Hapanotelius, the patron god of Kahana, the patron god of the shield, Ea, Elatum, Telepinus, and Durmita, Ishtar the mighty, Asclepius, Sin, lord of the oath, Ishara, queen of the oath, Hebat, queen of heaven, Ishtar, Ishtar of the battlefield, Ishtar, that's Easter, of Nineveh, Ishtar of Hatterina, and the Hattian warrior god of Eliah, the warrior god of Azira, Yaris, Zampanus, and then there are about 30 more gods that are mentioned. And after mentioning all these gods, storm gods, he finally comes down, goddess and goddesses of Amuru land, all the olden gods, Naris, Napsaris, Minki, Tuhuzi, Amanuki, Amizadu, Alau, Anu, Antu, Apu, Elil, Nihlil, the mountains, the rivers, the springs, the great sea, heaven and earth, the winds and the clouds, let all these gods be witnesses to this treaty and this oath. Quote, the words of the treaty and the oath that are inscribed on this tablet should Dupi Tisab not honor these words of the treaty and the oath. May these gods of the oath destroy Dupi Tisab together with his person, his wife, his son, his grandson, his house, his land, and together with everything he owns. But if Dupi Tisab or Tisab honors these words of the treaty and the oath that are inscribed on this tablet, may these gods of the oath protect him together with his person, his wife, his son, his grandson, his house, and his country. That was quite a pact, wasn't it? You talk about calling upon all the gods. I mean, you run out of breath trying to read them all. I only read a part of them to you. That is the record, the written record, of the very first attempt of mankind to effect a military treaty so that one nation would come to the aid of another nation if attacked. And if they didn't live up to it, he asked that all these gods, of course that didn't exist, would actually kill him and his entire family right down to his grandchildren and destroy everything that he ever had. I want to tell you about the UN Conference on Racism back in 2001. I think all of you know about multiculturalism and globalism, and you know that right now our government apparently is going to try once again to get the United Nations to cooperate with rebuilding some kind of a government and a system in Iraq. I don't know if you know the extent to which all of these many, many Marxist-Leninist groups, the anti-war demonstrators that are being orchestrated by some of those, the likes of Ramsey Clark, and their great massive demonstrations. There's going to be a huge Muslim demonstration in a few more days in Washington, D.C., because some of the very Muslim leaders who have sat down with George Bush and had tea in the White House and had tea with Hillary are claiming that they are not being given the kind of deference and respect they should, and are accusing the Bush administration of actually being anti-Muslim, which is absolutely not true. President Bush has bent over backward, you hear his back breaking, to try to give them all kinds of concessions with which I do not agree. But he has done it, and they're not a bit grateful, and there's going to be a huge demonstration. Well, the UN had a conference on racism back in 2001, and the hypocrisy of it is something that ought to make Americans really think. The conference was really an excuse to advance anti-Semitism, the grievances of black people against whites, and comparable complaints. An article by Alan Koruba on that conference on racism said, largely unnoticed is the xenophobia that exists on a daily basis in the United Nations. While the UN constantly hectors the U.S. to send money that constitutes 25% of its budget, we're only one member out of hundreds of nations, Americans hold only 7.2% of its more than 56,000 jobs. A study by the General Accounting Office, GAO, determined that at the senior decision-making level, only 2,076 Americans, or 9.5%, hold such positions. This prejudice exists throughout the UN's operations. The World Food Program, for which the U.S. provides more than half of its funding, is staffed by 90% of non-American personnel who each year find it difficult to account for tons of food that simply goes missing. One time we were sitting in a place where between the bedroom section of the Intercontinental Hotel on the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem and the walkway that went across a driveway that allowed trucks to come into the kitchen to the rear, and we were sitting there, and it's kind of a part of the restaurant, and here came a pickup truck. I watched it, and the guys got out, and they backed up to the restaurant supplies on the dock there, and they started passing one another huge, great big bags of wheat, must have weighed about 100 pounds or more apiece. Stamped clearly on it were joined hands and a UN and a USA flag from the people of the United States. And they were busily stealing that wheat. And of course, the money that goes from the black market sale of Kansas corn and of Illinois wheat that a lot of these nations are ripping off as it's sent by American and other flag ships all around the world goes into the pockets of some of these bureaucrats in the United Nations. Earlier this year, we had a seat on, earlier in 2001, the United States once had a seat on the UN Human Rights Commission.
But at the urging of many nations of Africa, and especially China, with its wonderful human rights record, they decided to make Cuba the head of the Human Rights Commission. And so a number of African nations, and that includes Rwanda, Burundi, and Nigeria, helped to oust the United States from the UN Human Rights Commission, and they put all these other nations, including Libya and Cuba, in charge of the UN Human Rights Commission. Doesn't that make you feel wonderful? Now, have you heard about the World Summit on Sustainable Development? If you have a private computer, just type in World Summit on Sustainable Development and look at what they did down in, Rio de Janeiro a few years earlier, and then last year over in Johannesburg. And what this is a world organization under the aegis of the UN that is talking about water, food, the environment, the rainforest in Brazil, all of these conditions about human squalor, misery and disease, the lack of drinkable, potable water in many parts of the world, about wars, about human life. It's talking about the deep fault line between rich and poor, posed a major threat to global prosperity and stability. And they wanted to talk about clean water and sanitation, and especially, get this, infant mortality, which is up to 50% in many nations. Up to half of the kids in India die before age 5. And, of course, the United States desperately tries to keep them all alive, as if we want more and more people in India, which has never supported us in the United Nations, in which we have given billions of cubic tons of wheat over the last 30 or so years to keep millions of them alive because they won't eat the protein it's walking around on the hoof. Because as I saw, and I've related to you on television here a few months ago, was an Indian woman, a mother, sitting at the feet of a cow, and as the cow urinated, the mother very gratefully took it in her hands and anointed the head of her bald little baby that was there of a few weeks of age, anointed the head of the baby in cow urine because the cow is supposed to be holy, called a Brahman cow. Have you ever heard of, they call it in Texas, Brahma, but over there they call him Brahma. And Brahma is the name of one of their gods, and they believe that cattle are holy. And so when they burn people at what's called the Ghats, G-H-A-T-T-S, along the Ganges River, and they shove the ashes in there, and the cattle excrement, human excrement is there. When I was in Bombay and the tide was out, there were hundreds of people in full sight of one another on the mud flats that walked out there, dropped their trousers, and were busily defecating. Saw this in my own eyes. So these people live in these conditions, and they are also part of these organizations that are talking about how we need to have clean water and sanitation and longer lives. And of course, they really jump all over the United States because China is now saying that with their birth control, a marvelous birth control, it's not only abortion, but actually a government program that most of the people ignore that says they should only have one baby instead of two. And so the World Health Organization under the UN is really lauding and praising China for working so hard to bring down its tremendous population explosion. But the population explosion is huge in China, as well as in Bali, in Indonesia, the Philippines, in Bangladesh, in Pakistan, and especially India, which is the second largest nation on the face of the earth. As they talked about the global environment, they list the United States because we bowed out of the Kyoto Agreement. Did you ever read about what those are? Those were statements made by the United Nations when it met in Kyoto under the aegis of this constant development organization that has a certain name that I gave you a minute ago for sustainable development. That had we been signatories to that, it would have absolutely destroyed our industry. Most of our industry couldn't even have survived if we'd gone along with what they're trying to implement in the United States under the aegis of environmental concerns. So the United States opted out of Kyoto. And meanwhile, they call us the world's greatest polluter, the world's most dangerous nation. The bulk of the population of the world believes in their heart that the United States of America and George W. Bush are more dangerous than Saddam Hussein ever was. They believe that in their hearts because they're being told that by the propagandists and by their clerics and by their religious and government leaders, oftentimes. So, along comes international law. You know that there is a world court in The Hague, and you know that they are lobbying to get men like Tommy Franks and George Bush under arrest in manacles to appear before them under war crimes trials. And if they have their way, American military men will not be safe and could be hauled before them in the same way that Slobodan Milosevic and the likes have been, and will be called war criminals. You ought to study, as I've been doing here lately and looking it up, about international law. Now, all of these are nothing more than attempts at globalism. They are attempts at destroying British and American sovereignty. They are attempts to have a huge, big agglomeration of have-not third world nations pulling the levers and the switches and telling us what to do, how to live, how to conduct our lives, how to conduct our businesses, how to conduct our homes, how to have our educational systems arranged. And they want to actually intrude into every way of American life that you can imagine. The UN World Court, endorsed by the Clinton administration, is nothing more than an attempt to create an independent military free to invade any nation that will not acquiesce or cede to its, that is, the UN authority, will not cede its own sovereignty to the UN. And by denying, giving up, and acquiescing and giving our sovereignty to the UN, it would actually eventually result in a world army that could attack and invade the United States. Well, as you look into some of this, it is just mind-boggling. And I cannot help but wonder why the United States is still even involved in the United Nations. If you go to Hebrews 2, 5 to 10, the Apostle Paul wrote, "For unto the angels has he not put in subjection the world to come, whereof we speak." Notice that, the world to come. "But one in a certain place testified, saying, What is man that you are mindful of him?" All right, what is man? Let me tell you this, no scientist knows. No evolutionist knows. No Islamic fundamentalist cleric knows. No professor in Berkeley knows. And I'll tell you this further. The Pope doesn't know, and the chairmen of the boards and the heads of the various organizations, such as the American Council of Churches of all the fundamentalist Protestant organizations, do not know. They all universally think, whether they are pagan, heathen, animist, Confucianist, Satanist, or nominal Christians, that man is either in a transitory state somewhere between insects and animals and is going to come back with some other kind of a life, or that he has an immortal soul, which is his true psyche, and that at death that soul goes flitting off into nirvana or paradise or maybe purgatory, where he's not quite expunged of all of his guilt until he is eventually to get into the beatific vision. And so not a one of them know what man is. And the Bible says, "What is man that thou art mindful of him? Why should God pay any attention to us? Or that you visit him, that you interfere in his affairs, that you come down and talk to him, that you give him information? You made him a little lower than the angels." Believe it or not, God says that the next step up between us and God is a spirit, invisible, angelic creature, of which there are the 24 elders, there are seraphim and cherubim, and there are archangels, only three that are mentioned in the Bible, one of whom became perverted and is Satan, and billions, perhaps, of angelic servants of God. "You crowned him with glory and honor. You did set him over the works of your hands. You have put all things in subjection under his feet." If you ever get a chance, and you're traveling where it is, go by some big plant. At least go to Detroit sometime if you ever get there and go to the automotive assembly line. If you've never seen a Bessemer oven in a big steel plant, you ought to go do so. If you've never been to the line, as I have been in several places out in L.A., where the Rockwell firm and also over at Dassault, France, I should say, in not Marseille, but another major French city where the Dassault, Breguet, Fanjet, Falcon, and the Mirage 1, 2, and 3 are built, and actually be there and see them under construction. If you were to see the incredible marvels of the technological expertise of human beings and what we have managed to produce, if you were to go to a simple glass-blowing factory and find out how wonderful crystal is made, see how things are made, see what the human mind, human ingenuity, human invention, human imagination, and the human hand has been capable of doing. Thou hast put all things in subjection under his feet. For in that he put all in subjection under him, he left nothing that is not put under him. But now we see not yet all things under him. But in contrast, we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he, by the grace of God, should taste death for every man. So the story of creation, of the fall of man, as it's called, into sin, of giving in to the base elements of human nature, which is vanity, jealousy, lust, and greed, and instead of replacing it with the God nature, which is love, mercy, compassion, faith, you see what man has been doing ever since the very first group of people tried to huddle together in a town or a city for protection against animals and or each other. And they have striven through all this time to find a solution so a man and a woman can merely live at peace, pursue their lives in their chosen vocation or profession, have a place of shelter, food, and clothing, have a place to produce, nurture, love their children, and to see their grandchildren or great-grandchildren come along without someone taking it away from them, stealing it, destroying their property, warfare coming along and polluting everything. You know, it took men centuries to learn that he shouldn't dig the well near the outhouse. I'm sorry to tell you that, but that happened to be true, and cholera had destroyed millions of people down through the years. They didn't have sense enough to know about groundwater. You go down there to the limestone and 5 miles away. Just like the whole herd of sheep that was wiped out in Colorado one time because of a U.S. arsenal that was actually allowing the leakage of some big 55-gallon oil drums in which there were chemicals, and it leached about 30 miles away in the limestone and killed a whole bunch of sheep when it came up in the water. And it's taken man centuries to learn the simplest thing about the environment and how to avoid polluting his own environment, including his own backyard. Now, having said that, this wonderful scripture is a contrast between the true destiny of mankind and the hopes and dreams and aspirations, the desperate desire of all of mankind from time immemorial. What does any average Arab want? Well, among other things, he wants peace, he wants prosperity, he wants a wife, maybe five of them. He wants happy little children chortling, gurgling around, jumping around, bouncing them on his knee. He wants to skid to his face on the Persian prayer rug about five times a day till he wears a big callus on his forehead and pray to Allah. But he also can't really be at peace as long as that cleric, the imam or the ayatollah in the mosque is telling him how horrible, how rotten, what these baby killers. Matter of fact, didn't you know they were telling all of the people, youngsters and old alike, in Iraq, that in order to become a United States Marine, you had to eat a baby. They sat in their mosque as if, what? Really? Oh, I hate those Marines. Had to eat a baby. And so, when you get down to what does it take to make people happy? No Arab can be happy as long as a Jew lives on the face of the earth. Back in the 60s, I did hundreds and hundreds of programs talking about the difference between the Soviet Union desire for peace and the American desire for peace. The Soviet Union and all of its dupes could not be peaceful so long as we existed. And the Arabs cannot be peaceful as long as there are a Jew left alive on the face of the earth. The Jews, they're perfectly willing to live at peace and cooperate as neighbors and have secure borders with the Arabs. They don't have the same hatred. Some of them do. Kahani and some of those people, he was assassinated. I know there have been rabid people and certain exceptions among the Jews, but as a religion, Judaism is not a religion as it is evidenced and as it is practiced by people today in Israel and throughout this land and all over Europe which has as one of the unspoken tenets of its faith the desire to murder as many of its enemies that it calls infidels as it possibly can. There's only one great religion that you know of in which the sixth tenet of faith, an unspoken tenet of faith, is to obliterate at the edge of the sword or the point of a gun if they can, everybody who does not agree with them. Now, whether we want to think we are at war with Islam or not, and neither here nor there, Islam is at war with us. And you and I had better not go to Casablanca. You and I had better not be found in Riyadh. You and I had better not get on the next airplane and go to Jeddah. We better not go down there to the Middle East. We better not go to places like Yemen. I don't think you'd want to go tomorrow to Saudi Arabia and just be a tourist and run around and look at the sights, take your camera and your chewing gum. I don't think so. I think you'd want to stay away from those places. The State Department's got a list as long as your leg of nations where you don't want to go. You can include almost every country in the entire continent of Africa. You can include almost all of Southeast Asia except Australasia or Australia. You can include being real careful to even go to the Philippines. You can certainly include an awful lot of the Middle East, if not all of it. The only exception is Israel. And even there, you're taking your chances, aren't you? Which cafe you go into, or what street you walk down, what hotel you stay in. It isn't real safe for Americans to travel many places in the world anymore, is it? Oh, you can go to London, but you know, bombs will be exploding there and have been too. So you got to be careful even in London. I used to go in and buy a necktie in a little shop at the Hilton Hotel. Imagine my surprise one time when I just barely got back to the United States and learned that the Northern Irish, had blasted the entire lobby in that shop to bloody rags in a Hilton Hotel in downtown London. I realized, well, it was a matter of weeks, and I might have been there buying a necktie while they were there planting the bomb. It makes you think. So having said that, what do you think the solution is? I mean, a rational person, unless you're Malcolm Muggeridge, like the British, lampoonist, who was talking about, he thought that the United States and Britain and all the other nations of the world, lemming-like, are rushing into their own destruction, and eventually, because he believed not in God but in evolution, we will be like a sort of a cyclical pattern of lemmings that when they overgrow their area, they just rushed en masse at a cliff and all committed mass suicide. Maybe left just a few of them around to start over again. So he thought that we would all become, again, nothing but amoeba. And that all of humanity would just destroy itself, and we have that capability about 40 times over, and then begin again like some primitive form of life, and the evolutionary cycle would finish again. Now, isn't that a wonderful thing to look forward to? What hope these people give humanity? What hope did Jesus Christ of Nazareth give? All the prophecies about Christ talk about global government. I believe in globalism. I believe in the New World Order. But globalism in the hands of Jesus Christ, the New World Order of the Kingdom of God Almighty. And because I believe in it, does that make it happen? Of course not. Because others by the millions and billions do not believe in it, does that make it not happen? Of course not. You don't need to believe in it to make it happen. It's going to happen anyway. It's the only solution for mankind. And it's going to happen, notwithstanding the doubt of mankind. He goes on to say, we see Jesus made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he by the grace of God should taste death for every man. For it became him for whom are all things, for the purpose of his being, for his destiny, for the fact that the other member of divine Elohim who became Jesus Christ, whose name was the Logos or the Theos, died for his own handiwork, created man and woman with his own hands, breathed into their nostrils the breath of life, came down to die for their sins to show mercy like you cannot imagine. Like one huge psalm of more than 100 and some verses, for his mercy endureth forever. It became him for whom are all things and by whom are all things, read John 1, in bringing many sons unto glory. That is anathema. It doesn't matter that it is, but it is anathema to all Protestant churches. They will cling to their pagan doctrine of the soul. They will not agree that man can be born of Elohim. That you can first be begotten, that the Spirit of God can change the nature of man into a nature that is godlike and divine, that it can supplant vanity, jealousy, lust, and greed with all the wonderful attributes of the Holy Spirit. Love, joy, peace, goodness, mercy, gentleness, meekness, and faith, and replace avariciousness and cunning with generosity and love. They agree as far as Christian living, they agree about character building, they agree about family and family values, they agree about child rearing, oftentimes not the way I do. Many of them abhor what they call corporate punishment, or corporal punishment, physically spanking a child for infractions. But by and large, the average Protestant church or Catholic church believes in certain amount of discipline in the home. They believe in preaching all kinds of sermons about love and hope and joy and peace and faith and all that. They can take all of the attributes, the three graces, and preach interminably about them. But so far as the ultimate destiny of mankind, they don't have a clue. And they got so angry at Jesus Christ, they meaning the religious leaders of his time, they said, Who does he think himself to be? He makes himself equal with God. Because he said, before Abraham was, I am. And when he prayed, before he was to go out and to be murdered, he prayed to his Father, O Father, glorify me with the glory that I had with thee before the world began. Now, in a nutshell, this book, the Bible, is the story of our Creator, whose name, from the time that he was born of the Virgin Mary, became Jesus Christ. But prior to that time, the one who said, let there be light, let the dry land appear, let us make man in our image, was divine Elohim, the speaking spokesman member of that family called Father and Son. Bringing many sons unto glory, behold, I and the children you have given me, Isaiah 66, how can a nation be born in one day? At the resurrection, what will you be? You're to be resurrected, not to become like a dog or a pet, to lie there and to be very, very pleased when you hear the tread of the master on the stoop, but you're to become a member of that family. And the only hope for mankind is for you, for all of those who are called to fulfill that calling, because it says the whole world groans and travails in pain until now, waiting for the manifestation of the sons of God. Wrote the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 1. It says in Matthew 24:29-31, talking first of all about all the great things that are going to happen in the tribulation, immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and they shall see, then all the tribes of the earth shall mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, a sound that is audible that millions will hear, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. Peter said in Acts 3:18-21, but those things which God before had shown by the mouth of all of his prophets that Christ should suffer, he has so fulfilled. Repent you, therefore, and be converted, that your sins may be blotted out when the times of refreshing shall come from the presence of the Lord, and he shall send Jesus Christ, which before was preached unto you, whom the heaven must receive until the times of the restitution, the replacement, the restoration, the rehabilitation of all things which God has spoken by the mouth of all of his holy prophets since the world began. You know, there's a prophecy over in Jude that Enoch spoke and said, quote, behold, the Lord cometh with 10,000s of his saints to execute judgment upon all and to convince all that are ungodly among them of the ungodly deeds they have ungodly committed and all of their hard speeches which ungodly sinners have spoken against him. And Enoch was taken, or was, quote, translated and was not found. Yet you read in the 11th chapter of Hebrews of Enoch and that God preserved and protected his life, and yet it said three verses later, these all died in faith. And later at the end of that chapter, these all died not having received the promise. Enoch was the seventh prophet from Adam. And so long before the flood of Noah's time, there was a prophet, and before him another prophet, and before him another prophet. And Seth was a prophet of God, and so was Enoch. And they were preaching the gospel of the coming world-ruling government of God. Behold, the Lord cometh with 10,000s of his saints to execute judgment upon all. Pre-flood. From the time man first walked the earth, God Almighty has always given mankind a witness. He's never been without a witness. And he's never been without a human man, one man sometimes at a time, or a human organization of men and women who have been true and faithful to that one great message. We are made in the image of God to become the children of God, and to become, with Jesus Christ, judges, princes, kings, and to rule the world with a rod of iron for 1,000 years to show in that 1,000 years the perfection and the flawless wonders and glories of the kingdom of God, toward which man has striven without knowing how to do so from the very first time any human society ever existed on the face of this earth. The only reason for any human society to coalesce and gather together was for the well-being of the many. It was for their protection, for their benefit, for their goods and services, for their prosperity, for their long life, for their happiness. But they have never known how. Now remember what I went through with you at the beginning of all of this, of the absolute failure of the United Nations, and not only that, but every other pact, treaty, and agreement that man has ever effected on this earth in the history of mankind. From the beginning, God has proclaimed his intention to set up his kingdom on this earth. And it is going to be one world government. It's going to have one capital city, Jerusalem. It's going to have one law, the Ten Commandments, and all of the spiritual application of those Ten Commandments that Jesus Christ taught. It's going to abolish war. It is going to have long-lived people with happy families and children. It says in Isaiah 65:19, I'll conclude with that, I will rejoice in Jerusalem and joy in my people, and the voice of weeping shall no more be heard in her, nor the voice of crying. People cry because they're in pain. People weep because they are suffering. They cry and they weep because they're heartbroken, because they feel lost, because they're hurt physically, emotionally, or mentally. There shall be no more thence an infant of days. Human life, reproduction, is going to halt in the great white throne judgment. And that's when the billions of people who are right now dying in these bombing explosions and that died in the Iraq War, that are going to die in the nuclear bomb, World War III, that is going to come along, will come up, and here will be their lot at that time. Some of them die, boom. They're alive one instant, and they're dead the next. They're not hurt. They don't feel anything. I know it's hideous. It's horrible to think of these rotten bombers and these people who actually strap explosives to themselves. When they blow up, they blow up. Whatever fanaticism and mental thoughts go through their mind as they scream to Allah and pull the trigger, I have no idea, any more than those idiots in those airplanes that see those great big towers approaching, and all of a sudden, boom. But they're alive one minute, and they're alive again in far less than the next minute. And this is the world they're going to come up in. Not going to be a world of the United Nations. Not going to be this rotten, wretched, sin-sick, war-torn world of today. It says, the child shall die 100 years old. Everybody gets to live 100 years. Fruitful, happy, healthy, productive years. But the sinner, being 100 years old, shall be accursed. They, the people generally, all of mankind, will build houses and live in them. They will plant vineyards and eat the fruit of them. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. For as the days of a tree are the days of my people. You ever been to the sequoias and seen the General Sherman tree? Take something like, what, 6, 8, 10 men, I forget, to link hands around it. 36 feet through. The first great limb that is up there about 60 feet is so big that it's bigger than most Douglas firs. That one tree has enough board feet of lumber in it, it could build 45-room houses. The General Sherman Sequoia tree in Sequoia National Park in California. Awesome. He says, as the days of a tree shall be the lives of my people, and mine elect shall long enjoy the work of their hands. They shall not labor in vain nor bring forth for trouble, for they are the seed of the blessed of the eternal and their offspring with them. Think of that. No alcoholism, no drugs, no PCP, no angel's dust, nothing to snort, nothing to mainline, nothing to shoot up, no proms where girls get pregnant and sometimes youngsters get killed in accidents, no people sneaking around putting arsenic in the punch at a church social, nobody sneaking around getting his kicks out of putting strychnine in a quart of milk in Seattle, no bomber approaching a group of young girls trying to kill them all. It says, it will come to pass that before they call, I will answer, and while they are yet speaking, I will hear. The wolf and the lamb shall feed together, and the lion shall eat straw like the bullock, and dust shall be the serpent's meat. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, says the Eternal. You know what? Even thinking of all these Protestants and thinking of all the Catholic religion and all the other religions, even if they thought that all this is a nice dream, you'd still think that they would hope for it and want to believe in it. But they reject it out of hand. They do not believe in it. And the bulk of them don't even believe in the necessity of a resurrection. And when a loved one dies, they will not read 1 Corinthians 15. They will not give them the greatest comfort that you could give anybody who has lost a loved one by preaching the truth of God out of His Word about the state of the dead and the coming resurrection of the dead. And think of how many people there are who think maybe, just maybe, their loved one is not up there, but in that other place. And what kind of a relief and comfort it would be if the teachers and preachers would tell them the truth of God about where or what is the state of the dead and when is the resurrection going to take place. I will conclude by saying there again, you don't need to believe a word I've said. And I know that all of you in this room do, but many who will be hearing this tape might not. It doesn't matter whether you believe it or not. It's going to happen anyway.